Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Hey everyone, before we start the episode, I just wanted to take a quick second, John and I, to say thank you for the great response. We were on the Dennis Miller Show this week, and we got a great response. We had a huge spike in traffic from that. So thank you to Dennis for having us on, and especially to Christian and Lindsay, who were great. They were in the studio. We really appreciate them and their support. But we also wanted to tell you that as a result of being on the Dennis Miller Show, John, what happened?
We had a gentleman reach out to us via our Facebook, and we're not going to mention his name, but he shot us a message, and I'll read this message.
And he only found us because of
the Dennis Miller Show. Yeah. So I'll read this message, and here we go. I just want to share this with you guys. I was a cop for 8 years, started 1 year out of high school. I can say that it shaped who I am now. After having to leave for medical reasons, I later became an EMT. This is a sisterhood and brotherhood like no other. Many of my wife's family did not know that I was a cop, but some did. I struggle at the social gatherings when people start to shit talk the police or give their opinion on law. I got very angry and feel like yelling, "Think how fucking dare you. You just don't know." I stop myself and just walk away. It's hard to sit on the sidelines or watch from the other side. I remind myself that everything happens for a reason. I'm currently awaiting a transplant for a kidney and pancreas. I had to take medical leave from being an EMT. In my current medical state, I can't be a responder. I have had nightmares for the past 2 years and think about things that have happened on duty all the time. I'm to the point I am hyper alert while out. People still ask me if I'm a cop, if I go somewhere. I try to maintain a low profile, but I can't shake some things. I don't live around where I used to work as a cop, so talking to people who are on my squad is not going to happen. A lot of bad things that have happened are starting to revisit me, and I don't have anyone to talk to. For the past few days, I started listening to your podcast and felt more at home. I've been told due to the work I did affected my health, but if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't have changed a damn thing. Keep up the good work. It's very therapeutic for me. Please feel free to share this if you wish, but I just request my name not be used. Right. So obviously we shared it. Obviously we're not using his name.
That came in at 9 o'clock on Friday night. So
yeah,
24 hours after, a little bit more than 24 hours after the Dennis Miller episode.
And we ended our conversation with him at 11:15 at night. So, we both messaged him pretty much, simultaneously. And sent him two links, one being to the Mighty Oaks Warrior Program, and then also to the other one, the Wounded Blue, which we've mentioned on the podcast before. I mean, we kind of just kind of gave him a little insight on what those both those groups do for people, and hopefully he reaches out, and I guess we'll see what happens.
Yeah, he. I told him, and I directly contacted Mighty Oaks, so they're aware, and he does qualify, so... what does Mighty Oaks do, John?
Yeah, so...
By the way, it's still weird to call you John. We can talk about
that. Yeah, we can talk about our names now. Weird. Well, technically, it's not my real
name. You know, even in the next coming episodes, there's still going to be a couple episodes left where we're using our nicknames, so just get over it.
It'll just be weird.
Yeah.
You know, let me read their mission real quick. So this is a Mighty Oaks Warrior Program. You can find them at mightyoaksprograms.org, and this is their mission. Our mission is to operate on standing commitment to reach the brokenhearted with specific calling to assist our nation's military warriors and families find a new life purpose through a hope in Christ after enduring hardship through their service to America. Now, I know it says military warriors, but that's not just military. It's open to law enforcement, paramedics, firefighters. They've got different programs for everybody, including spouses.
Right. So big shout out to Mighty Oaks and Wounded Blue. If you need help, you can give either one of them a shout. That's woundedbluefoundation.org or the Mighty Oaks Warriors Program. Just Google Mighty Oaks and fill out the application.
Right.
If you're our listener or if you who reached out to us, he already has the information. But if what he said rings true for you too, please reach out because that's what they're there for. And that's what we're here for. So if you need us, you can reach out just like he did, or you can reach out directly to them. But now we can go on to the episode proper, which is with Jeremy Stalnecker from the Mighty Oaks Foundation. We were on his YouTube show, and then we interviewed him for the podcast. So check out his YouTube channel. Check out our appearance on there. That was the first time we used our names.
Yep.
And the podcast is the first time we used our names.
And got to do it in a legit studio.
Got to do it in a real studio. So
Pretty awesome.
Dennis Miller, Mighty Oaks, they have no idea that we have no idea what we're doing.
Right.
But we fake it really well.
Right.
So, all right, on with the episode. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm your host, Thomas Gandy. It's kind of weird to be saying that.
It's very weird to be saying that.
We've gone by nicknames for so long, but we've decided that now pretty much everybody knows who we are anyway. We might as well just use our real names and give it some legitimacy.
Right.
So, as always, I am your host and the king of useless information. I'm a retired cop as well. And sitting next to me is my co-host,
you don't want
John.
Okay, there we go. I was like, do you not want to say my name for the first time?
I know. I want to say your name, John. I've bleeped out your name so many times because we always went with nicknames. It's weird to...
No more bleeps, people.
No more bleeps.
No more bleeps.
Yeah. Unless you say, like, somebody gave out operational information or named another...
That's true.
You know, military member or something. We'll protect their identity.
That's true.
What's up?
Nothing much.
It is weird to be here doing this.
Very weird to be doing it. Very weird to not have a headphone on. Very weird to not have a mic in front of my face. But we're in this awesome studio.
With Jeremy Stalnecker. Is it Stalnecker?
Stalnecker.
Stalnecker.
Yeah, Stalnecker.
Okay.
Yeah.
And because I read it and I'm like, I'm going to
screw
that
pronunciation. Yeah, there's a lot of letters, but it's just phonetic.
It's a great, I'm a hockey fan. It is a great hockey player name. Because let me tell you, hockey player names are all consonants.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never played hockey. But I have the name, it's all really that matters, probably.
So you are with the Mighty Oaks Foundation.
Yes.
And you were with the Marine Corps. You're still a Marine, as we talked about.
Right.
But you're just not
it's
active.
It's all very confusing. That's what we were talking about. Yeah.
And we were joking about how we always have that conversation we have a Marine on. But you invited us down here to your studio. So we are at the Mighty Oaks Foundation. We're sitting in this beautiful room with this beautiful TV and setup. And we are kind of swapping shows.
Yeah.
We are going to interview you for our podcast. And then you guys are going to interview us for your YouTube channel. And we appreciate you having us on and we appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for coming down. Appreciate you guys and what you're doing and for taking that 2-hour drive.
Yeah,
down to our
is worth it.
Our location
it.
Here,
totally worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, this place is awesome.
Just to see our logo up on a 4K TV.
Never thought I would see that.
Right? Exactly.
That's pretty cool.
So it is pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you'll have the video when you leave.
Yes.
So
we can prove that it happened.
Or we'll take a picture. I don't know.
Right. We'll take a selfie for the
sure.
What the kids call it, the gram.
Oh, for the gram.
For the gram.
Yeah.
So we appreciate you coming on. You. So you went into the Marine Corps when?
Went into the Marine Corps. So I always get two dates because it's very confusing.
Okay.
I went to officer candidate school in 1996.
Okay.
And I was part of a program that dumped me in the reserves for the time that I was in college, but I was commissioned in 1999 and that's when my active duty time started.
Got it. Okay.
So, yeah.
So what, now the difference in the 3 years is?
Yeah, I was assigned to, I was part of the what's called the platoon leaders class, or platoon leaders course, PLC program. So my officer candidate school split into two sections. I went to what's called juniors and then came back to what's called seniors. So I went to juniors right after my freshman year of college, which was 96, the summer of 96. And then while I was in college from that period forward, I belonged to Education Command. So technically, I was part of the reserves, which meant we drilled a couple times a year, and it was think Pooley.
Okay.
it's a similar program, but for officers.
Okay.
But my pay entry base date was 96. But then we trained and we did that stuff. I finished officer candidate school in 98, and then I was commissioned in 99. So yeah. So it's a weird, it's kind of a weird path, but.
That's but you got there.
No, I got there. I got there. Yeah. Yeah. So all I wanted to do was be a Marine. So when I saw the split program and I could go to officer candidate school while I was still in college, I said, that's what I want to do.
Right.
And then realized, I have to come back to this place a second time. Mm. It was a really bad decision, but it worked out. So, yeah.
Was it easier the second time?
No. No. Yeah, they break it into two sections. So, you know, you've been basic training or boot camp. You get dropped on day one, you get picked up by the staff, and you go through that whole process. Well, you have to do that a second time then. Now it's phase two, so you're learning new information from that day forward, but you're getting used to a new staff, all the stuff that goes along with it.
Yeah, instead of getting it all done.
Yeah, instead of just doing it over 10 weeks, right. I did it over 12 weeks, split into two sections. So it's a good program though, and I was thankful to be able to be a part of it. So
I didn't even, I honestly didn't know that program existed.
Yeah, I had no idea that's how it
works. Go to officer candidate school and go to college.
Yeah, and there are a lot of ways to do it, but for those that are in college, not part of an ROTC program or something like that, it's a good opportunity. I get a stipend for books every year, to just kind of keep me moving through college. Sure. And so kept me connected to the Marine Corps.
Reminded you where you were going.
Yeah, it reminded me where I was going because we had drill a couple times a year. It just kept it fresh and kept it, I think that's the reason for the program because it drags you through those 4 years so you don't get distracted and do something else.
Did you know you wanted to be an officer? Or is that just kind of how it evolved as you?
Yeah, so.
By the way, you are our first officer.
Very first.
In the military.
You're blessed.
Show.
You just don't know it. But this will probably be your most listened to show.
Yeah, we have embraced by the presence of. This will probably be our most controversial show.
People will stop listening immediately when they find that out. It's like, officers. Yeah, so I was raised, my dad is a pastor, pastored a church, started a church. And I always kind of joke that the one thing you learn growing up in a pastor's home is that you don't want to be a pastor.
Right.
So
you guys are like a club. Like I work with somebody and they go, "Oh, we're a PC,
yeah.
Pastor kid,
oh yeah,
PK,
yeah.
Pastor kid."
They have a really bad reputation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they either
same with cops kids. Yeah, by the way,
I'm sure it's a similar situation, right? You see your dad doing this, and then you're doing this. My dad's awesome, and my family's great. It wasn't that I had anything against him, but when I was 14, I said, "Hey, Dad, I'd really like to do something other than ministry. Is that okay?" He's like, "Yeah, whatever you want to do." I said, "Well, then when I get out of high school," so I was 14, I was getting ready to go into high school. I'd like to enlist in the Marine Corps. That's all I want to do. That's all I care about. He's like, "Yeah, maybe not that. Let's talk about that for a second.
Go another route.
Whatever you want to do." Accept
so,
that.
So he said, "You can go, do whatever you want to, but we would really like for you to go to college." And so he made it possible for me to go to college. Actually studied criminal justice because I opened a catalog and said, "This doesn't look too hard." Mm. I watch cops every Saturday afternoon. Right. This is interesting.
It's a game film. You're good.
Yeah. And unfortunately, nobody told you cops is the best example of what not to do.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty exciting for me.
Great recruitment
tool.
Oh, exactly.
Great recruitment tool. So, I thought, well, if I ever leave the Marine Corps, which you can't know what your life is going to bring, but I leave the Marine Corps, maybe I'll go into law enforcement, and that was it for me. I didn't want to do anything else. So I did. I went to college, received a criminal justice degree. But in the process of figuring all of that out, we had a family friend who was a Marine officer. Mm. He said, "Look, if you're going to go into the Marine Corps and you're going to go to college anyhow, you might as well go the officer route. He's the one to talk to me about these programs and not that officers are better somehow, but there are some opportunities to go along with that.
Sure. It's a different job.
It's a different job. So if you're going to do this anyhow, then you might as well go this route.
Got two birds with one stone.
Yeah, so it worked out really well for me.
And turns out the Marine Corps needs officers.
The Marine Corps needs officers, yeah. So I just wanted to enlist in the Marine Corps. Not just, but I wanted to enlist in the Marine Corps. I wanted to be an infantry Marine, reading stories as a kid and learning about the heroics of those who had gone before us, really sparked something in me. Just these stories are incredible. My dad wasn't in the military. My grandfather was, served in World War II. Never really talked about it, just kind of that generation. Yeah. He served, came home, and lived his life.
Right.
But my dad, my family, very patriotic and very much community service oriented and serve others, and that's what you should do. And so for me, that was, what's the pinnacle of life? It's being an infantry Marine.
Right. Have a high
and if I can lead infantry Marines, then I'll do that. So that was kind of my path. I'm a simple person. That's what I ended up doing.
It's always nice when you can do that,
right?
Yeah, and in the Marine Corps for officers, there are not very many guaranteed MOSs. So you become an officer unless you're going the pilot route. You go into a pool. You go to the basic officer course, which is a 6-month long course after officer candidate school. All Marine officers go there. And, however you score on various tests and various evaluations, you'll be lined up with MOSs. Okay. So, you know, you're kind of rolling the dice if you don't want to be.
So they evaluate you.
They evaluate
and decide
you.
Where you best
it's
fit
a,
the Marine
it's
Corps.
It's a crazy situation, right? So you have, you're broken at this school, basic officer course, you're broken into platoons, and there are a couple hundred lieutenants that are part of this, you know, class. And then you have your platoons. Each platoon has captains who are the platoon commanders for those lieutenants. And so they'll go through this evaluation process, and then they'll rate you and drop you into a third. So your top third, middle third, or bottom third. And then you can be the top, middle, or bottom of each one of those thirds.
Okay.
Right? So then they all go in a room, they close the door, and for like 12 hours, they sit in there and argue over which of their lieutenants is going to get the MOS that
they're
they desire.
Teams.
So you get to put down, I want, you know, this is my first choice, second choice, third choice, and then these captains get in a room, and I don't know how it all works,
they
but
decide your fate.
They figure out what they want. So, you know, a couple months before that happened, my staff platoon commander, Captain Thomas, called me in his office. Hey, you put down infantry, didn't put anything else. You have to put down three choices. What are the other two choices?
Infantry.
I really don't care. Yeah. You put whatever you want in those slots, because if I don't get infantry, then it really doesn't matter to me. Being a Marine is enough. I'm happy to be a Marine. But the only choice I have, or the only choice I would make, is to be an infantry Marine. That's all I've ever wanted to do. So he's like, well, you got to do something up. Anyhow, so it all worked out for me. And yeah, went to an infantry officer course after that, 10 weeks out in the woods.
So let me ask you this. Is that a common thing for a lot of officers in OCS to, when they put down their jobs, they're like, oh, I want to go infantry. It's always number one? Or is that kind of a weird, like for cops, it's kind of the equivalent of saying, I want to work patrol my whole life. And a lot of cops are like, I want to go to detectives. I want to go to SWAT. I want to go to special assignments. And you're going, no, I want to work patrol.
You know, it's interesting. I think it depends on the motivation of the lieutenant. If you're looking at a career, then the combat arms is a good place to start. You know, it doesn't have to be infantry. It can be tanks. It can be, you know, various artillery, some of the combat arms fields. There are some folks who, I want to be a logistician because I go to good schools. There's a career after that. The Marine Corps is maybe a starting point for me, but I can learn these skills and then take them somewhere else. Intel community is something a lot of people want to get involved in. So I don't know that it's you know, everyone goes infantry or wants to go infantry. Certainly a lot of people do want to become infantry officers. Now, thankfully, the infantry field is so broad that there are a lot of open infantry opportunities and billets. So,
yeah, we're always told every Marine is infantry first, right?
Yeah, so that's interesting too, right? That's like every Marine's a Marine forever, right? You're never an ex-Marine. Okay, I'm a former Marine.
Right.
What's interesting about the Marine Corps, and you know, this is true on the enlisted side or the officer side, is that basic infantry skills are taught, whether it's, you know, boot camp, enlisted Marines, even if they don't become infantry Marines, they go to Marine combat training, so they're learning basic infantry skills, they become a basic rifleman. For officers, it's very similar. We go to officer candidate school, which is like boot camp, it's an evaluation process, but that basic officer course, we call it TBS, is 6 months long. And it's that. It's here's how you learn to be an officer. Here's how you wear your uniforms. Here's how you, you know, do the stuff you have to do as officers. And we're going to learn some basic infantry skills. So, you know, I don't know how I feel about every Marine is a rifleman. every Marine is taught, however, how to handle a weapon. You know, how to be a provisional rifleman if they need to. Sure. And certainly, I mean, throughout history, even in the most recent wars, we've seen that happen again and again and again. You know, the admin kids, you know, platoon commanders who come from the log field or whatever, they're leading patrols and doing that stuff. So,
Fire department, the chief's got to be able to pick up a hose if need be.
It's true.
And it's, I think, and I can't speak for the other services, but certainly for the Marine Corps, it does create a cohesion because there's a basic set of skills that all Marines of whatever rank have. I was speaking at an event on base not too long ago, and the CO of the unit that I was speaking for was out on the track. We were out near the track. He's out on the track. I'm like, what is he doing out there? Oh, he's taking his Marine combat skills test. And he has to. He's a colonel. He's getting ready to retire. Yeah, he still has to do it. You know, there's some common skills and some common things that all Marines do, and I think it creates a real bond and, you know, a unique opportunity to speak the same language. We talk about combined arms in the Marine Corps as well. You know, your pilots are flying, but they're not separate. Those pilots have also been to the basic officer course. Those pilots spent time in the field and doing stuff. So you can speak the same language. And yeah, it's good. It's a long process, but it's a good process.
Now, you said with the exception of pilots. So a pilot is an MOS that you can be guaranteed?
A pilot is a guaranteed MOS. You take a test.
Right.
You pass the test. You can go into the pilot pipeline.
Yeah. Are you smart enough to be a pilot test?
Yeah, I guess so. I haven't taken the test because I'm not smart enough to be a pilot, but I don't know what's on it, but it's a basic skills test of some kind, and they still go to the basic officer course with everyone else, but from there they go to, flight school, and that's a guaranteed MOS, so they're not worried about whether or not they'll get that MOS, but everyone else is, who knows? We'll see what happens.
Oh, no, I was just out of curiosity. So if you don't pass the requirements after that initial test, then it's the needs of the Marine Corps?
Needs of the Marine Corps.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Everything at the end of the day is needs of the Marine Corps, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so now we just had this discussion at work, my day job. Pilots, are they, so you went to officer candidate school, so you're the first person we've talked to who's been to the same schooling as a pilot.
Right. Sure.
Is there a certain rock star status to them? Or is it just in their own mind?
I'm going to be real careful here.
And bear in mind, I knew a cop that left the LAPD to go be a Marine Corps pilot. So, that's my utmost respect. I'm just curious because it seems
I think
like
each community probably has their own identity within that community.
Sure.
The infantry community, which is the community I come from, would say there's no higher call than being an infantry Marine. So if you want to be a pilot, that's fine. Second place. But if you want to be a pilot.
Got it.
Okay. But certainly the schooling that pilots go through and the pipeline it takes to be able to fly is incredible. I don't think that most Marines are as taken with pilots as they are with themselves sometimes. But again, in the Marine Corps, there is a unique relationship between the air side and the ground side. We have our own helicopters. We have our own jets. We have our own transport planes. We have the ability, a Lance Corporal can pick up a radio and can speak to a pilot and get rounds on target, which is a very unique situation. Hmm. And because the language is common, it works and it works well. So I don't know. Every community will make fun of the other communities.
Of course.
But just very, very different job, very different role, and a very certainly different responsibility.
That's interesting. We always talk about that is, in your own military unit, you can make fun of people in your military unit, but don't.
Right.
Even somebody in a different unit, same branch.
Right.
Those are my brothers. You don't pick on them. The military, the Marines can pick on the Marines, but then don't.
Same thing.
Army. Yeah, absolutely.
And then you get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then what we find, like on this show, we can sit around a table. We can have a Marine, an Army, a soldier, a cop, a firefighter, and they can all give each other crap. Because they all know they've been there, done that.
Right.
And, there's this line of respect but then if somebody else attacks, we'll make fun of a fireman, no problem, but if somebody tries to make fun of a fireman,
we're not going to do that. Yeah, right.
Right.
It's a really interesting thing. One of my favorite things to do is make fun of the other services. But at the end of the day, if you haven't served, you don't need to say anything about anyone.
Right.
Right.
It's fair.
And it's a fun thing to do. And I think it's fun to speak in a place. And when you speak in a place where the majority of the audience would not be military, and I'll make a joke about, one of the services or something, people are like aghast, like, how could you make fun of the other services? Because it's funny.
Yeah.
That's why.
That's why.
Yeah. And if you were in the military, then you would laugh
laughing,
about this, right?
That's fair.
And so it's, it's an interesting thing. It's fun, though. It's fun.
Well, one of our frequent guests who was a Marine sent us a video of, I believe it was a Marine at an Army wedding. And he was giving a speech at the reception, and he was, during his speech, providing the best recipe for crayons. if you don't know, if you're not in the military, you don't know the common joke about that. You're like, what am I watching?
Right.
And yet every single person watching that who was in the military or anybody at that reception who's in the military is dying laughing.
Yeah, because it's funny.
Yeah, it's funny.
That's right.
No, that was a good video.
Yeah.
Who posted that?
I think it was Cartman.
Was it?
Sent it to us.
Oh, go figure.
Yeah. Well, he really does embrace the crayon side of things.
This is one of our Marine friends. Yeah. He's just one of those guys that really likes to let everyone know he was a Marine.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
There's nothing wrong with that.
We love him,
So when you were giving us, when you gave us a tour of this awesome facility, noticed a picture that was in your office.
Yeah.
And that was your platoon?
That was my platoon.
That was your platoon.
Yeah.
And what can you give us your bona fides, the whole, you know, company, regiment, platoon, all that?
Sure. Bona fides.
Yeah.
That was good. Yeah. I don't use big words most of the time, particularly in other languages. But
that's right. Well, you know, you testify in court, you got to know Latin sometimes.
Yeah, your bona fides. So my bona fides, I was, so I left infantry officer course, and that's in Quantico, Virginia. Moved to Camp Pendleton, California, served with the 5th Marine Regiment. 1st Battalion was my regiment, or was my battalion, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. And for a while, I served with Charlie Company within the battalion as a helicopter-borne company. So we did, a lot of helicopter-borne raids and operations. And this was in 99 and 2000. So there wasn't really a war going on, you know, but we served on the 31st MEU in Okinawa and had a good time. When I came back from that, though, I was moved over to Weapons Company. And my platoon was what we called the counter-mechanized platoon, which isn't Marine Corps designator. We, as a battalion, took two platoons and a section and put them into one platoon to make this counter-mechanized platoon. So I had the hardback Humvees, which you guys have seen, you know, rolling around the battlefield with machine guns mounted on the top. So I had the machine guns. The other platoon would have been the anti-armor guys, TOW missiles on those same vehicles. We took both of those and put them into one platoon. And then I had anti-armor Javelin missile guys also in my platoon. So it was a really strange kind of conglomeration, but it worked really well. No, it's not.
Okay.
We had a lieutenant who went somewhere else and some things changed in the battalion. So our operations officer said, hey, let's just take these. You've got good staff NCOs, they can manage it, and we'll just put them all into one unit, and then you can figure out how it works. So we did, but again, it was, you know, 2001, before anything had happened in the world, and so we trained a lot, and it was a lot of fun. But so I had, when we went to Iraq, I had 84 Marines, which again is very unusual in my platoon. Mm-hmm. Because of the way our platoon was, as our battalion moved, we served as forward and rear security and navigated for the battalion. So, it was a lot of fun. I wouldn't change anything about that. Yeah. Yeah, so that picture that you saw was that platoon in Baghdad in 2003, April 10th, 2003. We went into Baghdad, our battalion did. It's known as the Battle of Baghdad. We had just over 100 casualties, most wounded, a few killed. Took us about 12 hours to get to our objective, which was the Presidential Palace on the north side of the Tigris River, which is where that picture was taken. And it was an incredible battle that got us there. And we stayed there for 2 weeks and did some security missions and different things in Baghdad and then retrograded back and came home. So, yeah.
Well, now that we've arrived at how you went overseas, we'd love to hear whatever story you want to share with us.
Yeah, so, a lot of stories, I guess. Obviously, the most impactful thing in my time in the Marine Corps was the invasion of Iraq. I mean, I was active duty for 4 years. Most of it was peacetime. We, in fact, thought that we would be deploying in 2003, January 2003. We thought we would be deploying back to Okinawa to go back on the 31st MEU, which is based out of Okinawa.
Now, what's the 31st MEU?
31st is the number designator. MEU, Marine Expeditionary Unit.
Okay.
So Marine units, battalions are attached to these MEUs, put on ships. Somewhere in the world right now, all over the world right now, there are ships with Marines who are ready to go do whatever the country needs them to do anywhere in the world within a matter of hours. So that's how the MEU works. Quick reaction force for our country. The first people, you know, first boots on the ground, probably be special operations folks,
sure,
typically. But the first large-scale units would be Marine units just about anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And Marines can deploy anywhere in the world in just a couple of hours because they're forward deployed. They're sitting on a ship somewhere. They're training. They're ready to go. And so these MEUs are all over the place. But the 31st MEU, notably, is in an area of the world where not a lot generally happens. Humanitarian missions, traditionally, things like that. But when we believed we were going to the 31st MEU, it was a huge letdown, obviously. You know, an infantry battalion that's going to go sit on a ship somewhere and watch as the war goes on in Afghanistan at the time. We weren't in Iraq then. Last minute, We were told, no, you're going to Kuwait. Eventually, we'll probably end up in Iraq. And so, you know, everything that I did leading up to that was peacetime stuff, and we'll train for the sake of training and all of that. And then the windows of heaven opened up, and we were told we were going to Iraq, and that changed everything for us. I think we were told that September or October of 2002. And so, you know, money was right. dumped on top of us. We did a lot of, a lot of our training was not live fire training. And from the moment we found out we were potentially going to Iraq, everything was live fire training. The Javelin missiles, my guys who were the Javelin gunners, I think one of them had ever fired a Javelin, $100,000+ a piece, these missiles. So we didn't have them. And now, how many would you like to shoot?
Right.
It was that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, let's go down to the range and shoot those. TOW missiles, the same thing. A lot of, small arms ammunition, 50 cal ammunition. So, yeah, our training changed. Everything changed. And we went to Kuwait January of that year, 2003. Went to Kuwait. They took us from the airport on buses, dumped us in the desert. There was no camp. There was nothing there. There were Connex boxes with our stuff. And they said, all right, here you are. Get out. Put your two-man tent up somewhere and go to sleep. We'll figure this out tomorrow. And started to build a camp around our battalion and the other units that came. And there were a lot of other units that converged on that spot in Kuwait. And we sat there for several weeks. We pushed to the border of Iraq. We'd sit there for a while. We did some training, which was just show of force stuff. We'd move around. We set up live fire ranges right on the border. And that's what we did for a few weeks. And then eventually on the 20th of March, we pushed into the country. So, you know, it's funny, you can do a lot of things in your life, but those moments in combat, whether those moments were, you know, a street here in the United States for a police officer or whatever, you can forget everything. I forget my kids' names sometimes, but it seems like every moment from when we pushed into Iraq until we came home, I feel like I remember everything. I'm probably confused about some of that, but yeah, so we were prepared to push across the border. In fact, we were standing, the command staff was standing at our battalion commander's kind of hooch there, just south of the border, and going over some other coordinating instructions. We had done these big sand table exercises where we were walking the terrain. It was all built up in the sand. It was what the other side of the border was supposed to look like. And we'd walk through this, and what's the first day of the war going to look like, and how is all of this going to unfold? We went over, supporting arms stuff. We went over movements. We went over units. We went over the command and control aspects of how are you going to know what that unit is and where they are and those things. And we were told, and everything leading up to that was for a daytime attack. Early morning hours, it's going to be daylight, so all of our cues were visual cues, all of our markers were, you know, things in the ground and that kind of stuff. So that's what we were prepared for. Standing at our battalion commander's vehicle, he's kind of going over some of his last coordinating instructions. One of the radio operators ran up to him, handed him what we call a yellow canary. It's a yellow piece of paper that they take radio traffic on, put those messages on, handed it to the battalion commander. He stopped what he was doing. He looked up and said, oh, I guess we're going now. And so
what's that moment?
Yeah, so we're standing there. Oh, we're going now. So he looked up. The chaplain was standing there. He said, chaplain, why don't you pray for us? Right. And chaplain prayed for us. And then he said, get your guys ready. We're moving. And so that was late in the evening. The sun had not quite set, but late in the evening, the night before we were actually planning on moving forward. Apparently some some of the oil wells and some of the stuff and the objective that we were going to take had been damaged, was being lit on fire, and it became critical that we move.
Got it.
So we did. I just found this out recently. It's funny, you think you know a lot, but I just found out recently how that the other side of that conversation went, and apparently it went. General James Mattis was our division commander. And so General Mattis spoke to our regimental commander, who was Joe Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Mm-hmm. Joe Dunford. Sure. This is my chain of command, by
yeah,
the way.
Right.
And said, hey, we need to get there as soon as possible. How soon can you move? And he then spoke to our battalion commander, Fred Padilla, who just retired as a two-star general, an incredible leader. Said, how soon can you move? And he said, how soon do you want us to move? And so I guess that was kind of the genesis of that whole thing. And we did. So what was supposed to be a daylight attack became a very, very confusing nighttime attack.
Sure.
A lot of close air support and artillery support, as you can imagine. And then we breached the berm and secured the southern objective there, the southern Mayo oil fields, which is the gas oil separation plants where all the oil pipelines came into, and they did whatever they did there. And so we secured that. Extremely confusing, because everything we had prepared for was, you know, was visual. And now, because of the smoke in the air and the oil in the air, even our night vision equipment didn't work. So it was an extremely overwhelming evening, as you can imagine. But 1,200 Marines from our battalion pushed across the border and started taking, you know, the objectives that were there. And as the sun came up the next morning, we'd secured that objective. We were basically in place. A lot of the soldiers that were there, the Iraqi soldiers, were surrendering to us. Others were not. So again, that was extremely confusing. First KIA of the war, Shane Childers, was one of our lieutenants, was there, was shot in the midst of this. It was chaos. A lot of the guys didn't want to fight. Others did want to fight.
So simultaneously, you have people giving up.
Yeah, hundreds.
And people shooting at you.
Hundreds of people giving up. Others doing drive-bys in trucks and off motorcycles, trying to engage us, some in uniform, some not in uniform. There was a kind of a network of bunkers, so we were going bunker to bunker, clearing those.
So almost like urban guerrilla
tactics. It was just, yeah, it was kind of everything all at the same time. It was pretty insane.
It was a dumpster fire.
Yeah, it was pretty insane.
Now, were you there present when the first KIA happened, or was this just...
So Shane's unit was, Shane's platoon was clearing the set of buildings that accompanied that separation plant, mm-hmm. that gas oil separation plant. So they were clearing those buildings. My platoon, my section, was in a blocking position setting up security for the rest of his company. So we were on one side of that setting up security, or establishing a security position, and then they pushed... You'd have to see it, I guess, but they pushed from where we were through the buildings toward the major road that was right there. And there's a big blacktop road that went past that GOSP, we called it. And as they were coming out of the other side of those buildings, a truck drove up and some guys jumped out and started engaging his platoon, which did not go well for them. But but Shane was killed in the melee. So and that was just that first day, man. It was just chaotic.
Wow.
So from there, we sat there for a few days and did what we needed to do, and then started pushing north. Had some, you know, engagements all the way to Baghdad, a major engagement over a canal called the Saddam Canal, and just an insane firefight there. And then from there, continued to push to Baghdad.
Now, for the people that aren't familiar necessarily, because they haven't been in the military, what is the... As a lieutenant of a platoon, right? You have your soldiers, your Marines, they're engaging directly. What is your primary function and responsibility as the lieutenant of a platoon?
Yeah. One of the things, I was talking about this the other day with someone, one of the things that was unique about my time in Iraq was it was probably the last kinetic movement of the war. The first and only, probably. Mm. Kinetic meaning we're moving the way that you would expect for a large infantry unit to move over ground. We would hit buildings, we would clear buildings, we would do that in these little towns, but ours was not an urban fight primarily. We had tanks with us, we had access to artillery and you know, close air support, and we were moving very much in a large scale, you know, formation, if you will, what we would call maybe a movement to contact. We had all of our assets moving the same direction.
So if you're picturing a big column of vehicles,
right,
hitting
targets, right. You know, you think desert combat, right. You think World War II, right. Kind of movement. The war that I was a part of in Iraq was different in that I was a part of that.
Right.
The Marines who came after me, the soldiers who came after me, were involved in a very, very different war. You know, you think of the engagements following that.
That's more of the guerrilla style.
The guerrilla, yeah. I mean, urban, going street to street.
House to house, door to door.
You know, much more raid style than what we were doing. We were moving from Kuwait to Baghdad.
Right.
And if something was between us and Baghdad,
let's go through it.
We would engage it, we would deal with it, and we would keep moving. You know, and the war changed so much after that. But, you know, my specific role, because of the platoon that I had, which again was unique, I had 18 vehicles. Half of those vehicles were at the lead of our battalion column, 1,200 Marines, amphibious tractors, other tanks, other Humvees. So all of that was in that column. You know, that column stretched out over a couple of miles. And then at the rear of that column was the other half of my platoon, providing security. So where I was up front, I was the second vehicle back.
From the front.
My platoon was providing navigation. So we were navigating, which wasn't hard. I mean, you're moving north, you know. It was pretty easy. But we provided navigation. We'd stop at the checkpoints. We would call in checkpoints, and we did that. That was our primary responsibility for the battalion. And then providing security and engaging targets as we came to those, and then apprising the rest of the battalion of the situation as we saw it. But when we were involved in a firefight, my specific responsibility was twofold. I had two radios in my vehicle. So one was my platoon radio, so just controlling fires for my platoon, mm-hmm. telling the Marines where to go and what to do.
And the X, Y, and Z over on the left, and the A, B, and C on the right.
And I say that mostly it was coordination. They knew what to do, and I would just deconflict or coordinate between, okay, we've got these vehicles over here. Let's get some guys over here, you know, whatever. The Marines did the work.
Kind of I was overhead just the, view.
Yeah, I was the traffic director for those guys, and they did a tremendous job. And then the other radio was me calling back to the battalion and saying, this is what we have, we need support here, we need this there, this is what's going on, this is what we see, and then they would adjust accordingly. Sometimes it was me saying, you know, we went to the canal, we hit the canal. Again, it was one of those middle of the day situations, we're moving a battalion there to secure the bridge so that other units can pass through. But best intel says there's no one there, so this is not going to be an engagement, it's just going to be a seize and control. And there was a company of Republican Guard soldiers there, and you know, machine gun position, facing us, engaging us. Eventually, we got on top of the bridge, and there was a ZSU 23-4 anti-aircraft gun sitting on top of the bridge that determined that we were the most important target on the battlefield now. So it started to swing toward us. So we had to deal with that. There was a mortar position.
You had to deal with that.
We engaged it and
rounds downrange, right. Tried to destroy the gun and whatever.
And we did.
Once.
Yep. So we hit the machine gun position first, then we hit the anti-aircraft gun, but then we were caught in the fire of a mortar position, so again, we engaged that. But in all of that, it's just trying to direct that, it's asking for help, you know, or even asking for clarification to the battalion commander.
Right, sure.
We're supposed to stop here, this is happening here, what do you want us to do? And, you know, most of the time it was, do what you need to do to engage a target,
sure.
Right? Tremendous leadership in our battalion, so that was never an issue. But, you know, my role was really directing traffic and communicating back and forth up and down the line and getting eyes on and then doing other tasks as they became necessary. When we got into Baghdad, a lot of what we did after our initial engagement there the following couple of weeks was just setting up security positions so that special operations folks could go into buildings and pull computers and information, all the stuff they needed out of those buildings, and we would just provide security for them. So, yeah. Yep. So, you know, when I think of my time in the Marine Corps, there were a lot of things that happened. Made some great friends and some great connections and really enjoyed that, of course. But that time in Iraq, although a relatively short period of time, in a lot of ways has really become the lens through which I look at the world. So much of what I think about and so much of how I interpret events that happen in my life, I interpret through a lot of the things that happened there.
Right.
When I came home from Iraq, and we were talking about this a minute ago, I came home in June. I left the Marine Corps in the next 30 days. July 1st, I started working at a church. I will never be in the ministry. And then came home from Iraq. I left the Marine Corps and started working at a church. And in a lot of ways, I put my uniform in the closet and said, I'm done with that. Let me turn the page. And that next year was a train wreck. You know, I was married. I had two little kids. The fact that my wife stayed with me through that year is a testament to her grace and her love for me. I had good people in my life, but I did everything I could to
screw it up.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, even working at a church, I'd sit in a staff meeting and cause so many problems in the staff meeting. Mm. At a church, I'd be asked to leave. I mean, I was causing problems on the staff. You know, looking back, I have better perspective on that. But for me, a lot of it was, I just went to war. We invaded a country. We overthrew a dictator. And now I'm trying to get volunteers to do what they said they were going to do, and no one knows how important I am and how special I am. What's wrong with you guys? You have no idea. And then all of
Well, you're used to telling people to do it, and they do it. And there's a certain level of responsibility that the military and paramilitary organizations have of follow-through and responsibility.
And even just, you know, for me, working in the context of an organization and a structure that made sense to me, I try to explain this, and you know, I don't know if everyone gets it, but 4 years of active duty time, and there are guys who spend 20, 30, you know, or more years in the military. I decided I wanted to be a Marine when I was 14 years old. I pointed everything in my life toward becoming a Marine from the time I was 14 years old. I went to officer candidate school when I was 18 years old.
Right.
That was my whole life that led up to then 4 years of active duty time. So the only thing I cared about was that. When I separated out of the military after, you know, whatever that is, 15 years of trying to do that job.
Putting yourself that way.
I had friends, I had family, I had people that cared about me, but the people I cared about weren't there anymore. So it was really hard. And for me, part of my process of moving forward was taking responsibility. It was learning or understanding that I was the problem, not everyone else, that people should not understand me. It's like, why don't you understand me? Well, how are they going to understand me?
Right.
How are my wife and kids going to understand what I've, you know, they shouldn't. And that's not even fair to put that burden on them. But the bigger problem was I didn't understand then. So let me be responsible for me. But anyhow, in that whole process, it was me coming to the point where I had to stop looking over my shoulder, stop saying, I can go back there, I could do this again, or whatever. And so I tried to close that chapter of my life. I was always proud of my service, but definitely tried to close that chapter of my life, you know, of military service.
So let me ask you this, to take it back then. You start at 14, right? You point yourself that direction. I mean, you basically spent... If you did 15 years in the military and then, you know, wanted to do that from a very young age and then at 14 started making the decision, you spent most of your life trying to achieve that one goal.
Right.
And you achieve it, you get deployed, you go overseas, you serve in the invasion of Iraq. Where is the decision to separate and say, I'm done with the Marine Corps come from? Where is it? Is it, okay, I've done it and I'm ready to go on to the next thing, or is it, this isn't for me, or is it, this is messed up and it's not what I always wanted it to be? Where does that come from?
Yeah, specifically, so I love the Marine Corps, and it wasn't, when I left the Marine Corps, it wasn't because I was trying to get away from the Marine Corps. That wasn't it at all. And so for Marine officers, not to throw the officer card out there again, but let me explain to you guys, since you don't understand how officers work, right?
Just a little plea brand.
All right, so follow along if you can. All right, so in the Marine Corps, officers go through a process called augmentation. You come into...
Is that where they do the lobotomy?
Yes, that's when that happens. It is actually kind of when it happens. All right, so you go to officer candidate school, you go to your training, you do your thing, you're a second lieutenant serving in the fleet somewhere. You are... Not a lot of people don't understand this, but you are held under the reserve command. So you're an active duty Marine officer, but you're active reserve. You don't become an active duty officer until you finish this process of augmentation. So essentially, your first 4 years, your initial contract with the Marine Corps is a probationary period. At the end of that, they can say, we still don't have room for you, or, you know, thanks for coming, but whatever. So that's a process. So you go through the augmentation process, augmented into the regular Marine Corps.
Right.
And it's a simple process, depending on our time in history, right? I mean, there have been times when they were augmenting 99% of lieutenants who wanted to stay in, and times when they were augmenting 30%. It just depends. I wanted to be an infantry Marine. I had hoped to serve in conflict somewhere. I trained for it. I planned for it. That was my whole goal in life. And in the time when I came to that augmentation process where I had to decide, am I staying in or am I getting out, nothing was happening in the world. It didn't look like anything was going to happen for us. And I don't want to spend the rest of my life in a peacetime Marine Corps, because that's not why I came into the Marine Corps. And so let me transition out. So I turned down augmentation, and that set my end of active service date, and started to move toward that. And so could I have changed that at some point? I certainly could have, but I was then already on a track with my family, and I started working at the church. So all of those things have been put in motion so that when it came to a place where I could have, now we're in Iraq and now things could, you know, I could resubmit for augmentation. I would have been augmented just because of the way the world was at the time. But for me, you know, mentally, emotionally, you know, I was in a different place. We're in a different place. My wife had bought us a house near where I'd be serving at the church, and you know, I had taken that job, and everything was now pointing toward that. And so, at that time in my life, it didn't make sense to do anything else. But 3 months removed from it, all I wanted to do was go back.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's all you know.
It's all I'd known, and
for a long time.
You know, and a lot of my identity, most of my identity, was wrapped up in that. It was wrapped up in being a Marine, and I won't even say being a Marine officer, but just being a Marine and doing that job. And you know, it's funny, and guys who have served in combat, I think, could attest to this. Before you are in your first firefight, you believe you're going to do a good job when you get there. You believe that. Hopefully, you have that confidence. But until the rounds are coming back your direction, you don't really know.
So we say this all the time, you don't know.
You don't really know. You don't really know.
Right.
And so when it does happen, and you do the job that you were trained to do, and you do it pretty well, that picture that's hanging up that you guys saw has always brought me comfort, because I look at that and think, I did my job well enough that I was part of the invasion of a country. We took down our final objective, which was Saddam Hussein's presidential palace, and then I brought all those kids home. Some of them got hurt. None of them got killed. I brought them home. That was my job.
And you did it.
And I did it. And I did it well. And so a lot of the insecurities that go along with, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody this, but I'm not sure I'll do really well when things happen. I'm not sure I'll know what to do or how to act or how to respond. All of that went away. And now you look back and go, I don't know how to do what I'm doing now. But I knew how to do that.
Right.
And people respected me. And people that I respected me.
Yeah.
So
there's a certainty and a security in knowing you did it well.
Yeah.
And you were tested. I always, you know, my old man, he, like I said, has spent 25 years at LAPD and never had to shoot at anybody. And then, you know, 3 years on, you know, I get involved.
Right.
And he always goes, yeah, you know, there's a level of like, you've been tested. You know what you'll do. And I think when we are called to serve, the same thing with veterans who aren't deployed. They go in wanting to deploy.
Yep.
They go in wanting to do something.
Yep.
Nobody gets into the military to not want to make a difference unless you're drafted.
Yeah.
So that makes sense with a lot of the people we speak to, whether it's firefighters or, you know, firefighters, they're... We always joke their frustration comes from all the medical aid calls they go to and not from actually fighting fires.
Because they're all pyros.
They're all pyros. You put out, let me tell you, you grab your fire extinguisher out of the trunk of your police car, and you put out a fire before the fire department gets there, they are pissed. You know, because everybody gets into service wants to be the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
We don't. I mean, that's just, we don't not want to be that. So it makes sense that once you have that feeling, once you do that, you go, okay, I was tested, I did it, it forged me, and I'm pointing my life this other direction now. That and you sound like you're the kind of person where once you point your life a direction, you've committed to that course.
There are a lot of people involved in that decision.
And you're married, you're a partner now. You're not just you, you're the other half.
Yeah,
and so you make that commitment and you follow through with that. But there is a part of us that, like, you know, when I retired, I look, you know, my wife and I talked about it, and every decision we made about my retirement and about what I was going to do afterwards, we made together.
Yes.
So you have to look at it
from
that lens. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're happy about, you know.
You know what? It's funny, too, and you know, there are a lot of things that happen in that first, I always say the first year. My wife, and we've talked about this recently, we speak together sometimes, and she'll say it was a 10-year process, not a 1-year process. For me, it was a 1-year process.
Right.
But for her, she would say, it took about 10 years before I even wanted to really be married to you, you know, because I'd be so angry and get so frustrated and all this, you know, while trying to do good, while serving in ministry and trying to, you know, help people and do things. But that, for me, that first year, part of it was when the shooting stopped in Baghdad in April 10th, 2003, it stopped. We did our thing. We retrograded back. Other military units pulled in. We came home, and what gave me comfort was, well, the war is over anyhow.
Right.
There isn't going to be any more. So even if I stayed in, I'd be going and doing something I don't want to do.
Right. Not knowing.
It would continue. 7 months later, a lot of the Marines that I served with went back to Iraq. They were in the first Battle of Fallujah. Some of them were killed. Some of them were injured. And that happened probably 6 months into, 7 months into my my time removed from the Marine Corps. And it just didn't make sense to me.
And from that, did you ever, I mean, I don't know, but did you ever get a sense of if I had been there?
I don't think I ever felt like, you know, people ask me about survivor's guilt. I don't think I ever felt like if I had been there, that would have happened. I just felt like they're there, which means I should be there.
Right. Why, you know what I mean? It's to be home.
It's,
and they,
it's not. Right. Yeah. It wasn't like I felt like I could stop this somehow.
No, but it's I should be.
But
with
I should
them.
Be
That's
with
my
them.
Place.
I should be with them. Right. That's where I should be right now. And that was something I even tried to express to people that didn't serve. But at that time, it was happening, and I'm hearing about these guys who are being hurt and killed, and I'm trying to express that, and everybody's like, "Wow, yeah, that's tough." You know. So anyhow, you know, let's move on. And it wasn't their fault, but. It was a very lonely place to be.
They have no frame of reference.
No frame of reference. And it's a very, very lonely place to be, you know? And dark, not in a suicidal sense, but just in a, like you feel like you're in a hole all by yourself.
No, and I think that's one of the reasons, John, it's weird to say that.
Am I real name?
That was one of the reasons, John, I wanted to do this is because even just listening to other people share their stories, there's a reminiscence to it that you can connect with it, but there's also... You know, hearing somebody else say, "Yeah, when I got done, I missed those guys. I felt like I wasn't where I needed to be.
Right.
I felt like they were moving on without me.
Right.
Hey, guys, I'm back here.
Right.
You know, I still matter.
No one needs you anymore.
Right. We had a mutual friend. Now he introduced me to. It was one of our first guests. He was a combat medic MP attached to the 82nd Airborne.
Yeah.
And one of his experiences was, you know, they trust him with tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, and everybody in his unit looks at him and says, "You matter. You're that's Doc. You know, you got he's our guy, you know, and he's important, and he has a mission, and he has a purpose." And I mean, let's face it, everybody in life, if they're honest, is searching for their
100%.
Purpose, right?
That's exactly right.
So when you get in the military, you get into law enforcement, you get into the fire department, you become a nurse or whatever, you go into service. You find a purpose, or in some ways, you make a purpose for yourself, right?
Yep.
When that's gone, we just talked about this in the car on the way coming down here. When that's gone, I struggled with, my life doesn't matter now.
Yeah.
I don't matter. Nothing I do matter. It's all crap.
Right.
None of the, you know, so it's kind of nice that feeling kind of spurred me to go on and do something like this.
Yeah.
But I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's kind of that same feeling of, I should be there. This is arguing about this petty stuff is stupid.
Right.
And that's a common theme that we've had with pretty much everyone we've had on the show. It's a common theme. You know, and I think that's pretty well known nowadays in this culture.
I don't know, man. I think
it's pretty well known.
I think in our community.
Yeah.
In our community.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't know that people outside of the community understand that separation and that it's a grief. I mean, you lost a family. You lost, you know, it's not a physical loss, but it's an emotional.
Yeah. It's a bond.
Yeah.
It's a bond. So you had your year. So you have this year.
Yeah.
You know, how, I mean, I'm sure it was a long process, but what was your process coming out of that year and getting to where you are now?
Yeah. So, you know, why my wife would say is a 10-year. It's 10 years for her. You know, I feel like it was 1 year, but
it was only one.
It was 10 years. And I like
every does it in 10. I didn't want.
I try to be careful to say, and
she forgets you were an officer.
Yeah, that's right. I try to be careful to say and then communicate to people that you don't make a decision and then everything changes.
Right.
You make a decision and then start to work toward change. Right. And it is a long process. I get mad now. The other day, I started screaming at my kids. I'm always like, "What is your problem?" Like, I don't know what my problem is. Stop telling me what to do. You know, but so it is a long process, probably a lifelong process. Sure. You hope that there's more time between, you know, whatever, the longer you go. But for me, honestly, I went through, so, you know, this is why I look at it as a year. I came to 11 months of working at the church, right? My pastor, who loved me and cared about me and hired me, even though I didn't really have any skills, he called me in his office. He said, "Look, you know I care about you, but this is just not working. And something has to change." either you need to change or your job needs to change, I'll help you find another job. But this is not working. So what I want you to do is I want you to take a week off. This was a Friday. He said, next week, just go somewhere. And when you come back, tell me what you're going to do. And, you know, this was, again, this was early in the wars. You know, he pastors a church in Oceanside, which is a very military, very Marine Corps heavy community. But at that time, none of this was ever talked about. We never dealt with post-traumatic stress or, you know, combat trauma or separation, whatever it was I was dealing with. We didn't talk about that. He didn't know exactly how to deal with it, but he knew something needed to change.
Had he ever served?
No.
Okay.
No.
So that
you,
so, is a
yeah,
hard
oh,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, he and I have talked about this many, many times, and how he would deal with it and how we would deal with it would be very different now than it was in 2003, right? But that's how he dealt with it. And so, you know, I'm here for you. I want to help you. I don't understand all this, but you have to figure out what you want to do. And that was the best thing he could have done for me at that moment. My wife and I got in the car, dropped my kids off with their grandparents, got in the car, drove from Oceanside to San Francisco, took a week just driving up there and then driving back and stopping along the way and just talking. And that was probably the first time since I'd been home I talked about anything, not the war and stuff, but how sure. I felt right. and what I was thinking about and what I was dealing with. And she listened, and you know, through all of that, talking about it allows you to process it. But it also brought me to the point where I was able to get some perspective and go, I really am the problem. And I've heard vets say this, that say, I came to the point where I realized I was the problem, so I tried to take my life. And realizing you're the problem, it should not lead to you going, the only solution then is me taking my life. The solution is you realizing that you're probably the problem and you need to get help to move forward. Identify the source of the issue. The source of the issue is how you feel and what you've experienced and what you're going through and the fact that you're having a hard time contextualizing it and understanding it and you can't relate to people. That's what I mean when I say I was the problem. You know, the problem was me. It wasn't everyone else. I need to figure that out. And once I made that decision, I didn't do the right thing. I didn't talk to the right people or that, but I just decided I'm going to move forward. I have a wife that I care about and that cares about me. I have kids that I need to take care of. I have a job that I care about. And it really, for me, was just a process of humbling myself and saying, you know, I'm an ass a lot. Yeah. and that's my problem. That's not everyone else's problem.
Yeah.
And that needs to change. And, you know, for me, that was the beginning of really trying to figure some of this out and moving forward.
Sure. Now, it's interesting. It just occurred to me, and it's funny that you should say this. So when you're talking to your wife for the first time, did you have a moment, because I know I have, and I know we've had this a common thing, where something comes out of your mouth and you hear it for the first time after it leaves your mouth, and it's like almost not a thought. It's something that leaves your mouth, then it hits your ears, and you go, oh, wow, I didn't,
yeah,
like I said it, but I didn't even think about it. And now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh, that's an... I never considered that.
Right.
You know, you have those moments.
Yeah, I mean, I have had those moments. Right. I think that, you know, those conversations we had then, I didn't have those moments. What I did have was saying those things and talking about how I felt and expressing, you know, what I was frustrated about. The moment I had was, I sound like a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. I am blaming everyone else in the world for treating me bad or whatever. And they're just trying to do their thing. They're trying to live their life and do their job. And I'm like a 3-year-old on the floor having a temper tantrum. Mm. That's what I heard when I you know, had that conversation with my wife. And that's where I think I had to go, man, I really just need to humble myself and realize, you know, it's okay. And I'm not that important anyhow. I mean, I'm not that big of a deal, right? I didn't choose where I was going to be or, you know, the unit that I would be in, the incredible leadership that I would have, the opportunities I was given, the fact that I was a part of the invasion of Iraq and all this stuff. I didn't choose any of that. I mean, I struggled through the school where they would decide what job I would have. And I think just getting a healthy perspective on some of that, you know, you're not a big deal. And again, I don't say that in a demeaning way because we're all a big deal. We're all important. That's why we do the work we do. But you're not a big deal in that you're not alone. You're not the only person who's ever felt this way. Right. You're not special in that sense.
Right.
you know, let's see things the way they actually are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then we can start to move forward.
Right. Somebody loves you, but not everybody
right.
loves you.
Right. Right. And that's probably your fault.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting you brought up so this kind of goes back to what I was saying, is that you had said the veterans think when they realize they're the problem, they contemplate yep. suicide.
Right.
Right. And so I'm guessing with your organization and stuff, helping vets, you know, this is a common theme that you hear.
Yes.
And then I'll go back to something you had said earlier when you were telling your story. You guys reached an anti-aircraft gun, and you said, we dealt with it, and then we moved on. And we kind of backtracked for the audience and say, okay, what do you mean dealt with it? Oh, we destroyed the gun, yep. And yep. anybody resisting, and da-da-da.
Right.
So in the military, when there is a problem,
right.
you eliminate it.
That's right.
So is there a...
Nexus?
Is there a nexus to a mindset in a veteran where... When he identifies himself or herself as the problem, he is trained to eliminate it. Rather than try, they're not trained to fix an anti-aircraft position.
Right.
They're not trained to go out and talk to these guys and convince them
right.
to give up.
Or, right, right.
They're not hostage negotiators.
Right.
They're told, if there's a problem, you eliminate it.
Right.
And is there some basic programming going on that when they identify themselves as the problem that maybe triggers that?
That's interesting. I haven't thought about it exactly like that before, but I would say yes for some.
Anecdotally?
Yes right. for some, anecdotally, and no for others. I think it's one of two things, in my opinion. I think it's one of two things. I think it's either that. It's, you know, at some point in life, maybe through the military, through the police, police service, they've been taught to evaluate a situation, to determine the trouble point or the point of conflict, and then to eliminate it. They look at their life, they look at their spouse, their kids, their family, people that care about them. They realize, I'm the trouble spot, you know, I'm the point of conflict, I'm the obstacle here, and so I need to remove myself from the equation. I've heard that statement or something similar to it hundreds of times. I needed to take myself out. They'd be better off without me. Things would start to move again in their right. lives if I was gone. So I'm the
no
problem.
Good for them. Yeah.
Let me take myself out of the equation. So I think that is part of it. I think the other part of it is, and this is the other conversation I hear around that is, I realize I'm the problem. I look down the road, and there is so much work to be done to fix the problem. I just can't do it. It's overwhelming.
Yeah. And insurmountable.
It's insurmountable. And so it would just be easier for me to be taken out of the equation. I used to think that, because this is what we were always told, that suicide is the coward's way out or something like that. The more I've talked to folks, and now, you know, many, many, many people who have attempted suicide and ended up in a program like ours, I really do think there's a moment in a person's mind where they believe that the world would be a better place without them. Or they're so overwhelmed with that hopeless feeling that they just don't see another option. You add prescription medication and alcohol and, you know, other substances on top of that, and your ability to make sound decisions is completely removed, and you're responding to what you believe or perceive to be true, mm-hmm. which is, I'm the problem, I need to go, or I'm the problem, and I just don't have the energy to fix the problem.
And I'm going to drag a lot of people with me.
I'm going to drag a lot of people with me.
Terrible process.
Just doesn't make any
sense.
And
I'm not worth it.
I'm not worth it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So when we say, or I say, you know, you're not special, I don't mean that you're not worth it. I just mean that you need to understand you're not alone.
Yeah.
You're not unique. Maybe that's a
right.
better way of saying it.
No, but I think, you know, if everybody's special, then nobody is, right? That
right.
kind of a mentality.
right.
But I mean, everybody, it's like I said, you're special to somebody.
Yeah.
You mean something to somebody, and you know, whether it's in the, you know, human sense or the cosmic sense,
right.
you're you know, special to somebody.
Yep.
But there's nothing about the world will go on without you. So you have to decide whether you want to be in it or not.
And but when you realize that you're not alone, and you know, John's
right.
been to our program, and so you've seen how it unfolds. And really, our program is it's not clinical. It's not someone speaking down to anyone else. At least it's not intended to be that way.
No.
It's very much like, okay, guys, I was sitting where you were not too long ago. I was struggling with a lot of the same things you're struggling with. Let me tell you my story, and then let me tell you how I moved forward. And the power of understanding, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not special.
Right.
I'm not alone. That gives hope, and I think it reinvigorates to a sense. It gives an energy behind, if he could get better, because I just heard his story, then I can get better too.
Right.
And there's a lot of power in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And we're not good at doing the hard part, which is the sharing.
Right. And so, you know, people ask, why do you guys have the success that you do? Because we put people in an environment where they have to at least listen to other people share. Right.
Sure.
That
in itself is extremely powerful.
It's very powerful.
You can go through, I know I sat, like I remember sitting there and, you know, by no means do I think I'm the most badass thing that walked on this earth, but I know
that. Secretly believe that.
I think you're special.
but I feel like I have been through certain things that are pretty gnarly. And,
right.
But to hear other people's stories and you're like, I didn't see shit. I didn't see anything compared to this guy. It humbles you.
It does.
It does humble you. And you're like, okay.
There's always a bigger fish.
And you want to keep that. And you want to share your story.
Yeah.
There's a crazy connection that happens there. We've had one or two. So we've been doing this since 2011, 2012. Started in 2011, really started running the program in 2012. We've had 2,700 some folks come through one of those programs. We've probably had three that wouldn't get up and tell their story. But all of them say they're not going to when they show up.
Right.
But you start to hear people tell their story. You start to realize, I can connect to that. That makes sense to me. That resonates with me. And then you realize, you know what? I'm not unique. I really have, you know, struggled with some stuff. But so have they. And it's okay. We can move forward together.
Hmm. We've had people come on the podcast already that have said, I'll sit and
sure,
you know, sit and just kind of, you know,
yeah,
be there to be part of the discussion.
Right.
And then it gets to them and they're like, okay, so let me take, you
right,
know, there is a thing in being in an environment and the esprit de corps of the military, the esprit
right,
de corps of
right,
any paramilitary organization or any service organization, whether it's Salvation Army or the Peace Corps,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You have this group identity. You affiliate
exactly
yourself
right
with that kind of a person. So you take a person out of that environment, you put them in a civilian environment or an environment of people that don't share that identity. They do feel like they stick out. They feel like the green Twinkie in a bag full of marshmallows.
Yeah.
Then you take them
right
and put them like a program like yours, or you put them on a show like ours, you surround them with people that, again, make them feel like they're not alone.
Yeah, right.
And all of a sudden, it's okay to say the thing that you're afraid to say to normal people, because normal people will give you that look
right
of, oh, I can't believe you just said that, or
yeah,
I can't believe you just laughed at that, I can't believe you saw that, and then they treat you differently.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's with kid gloves or with disgust or whether it's with this kind of, it changes the dynamic. We don't want to do that.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest obstacles, particularly for veterans, and I think certainly in the police and fire services, to getting help is they look at everyone around them and go, you have no idea what it's like to be me.
Yep.
And so I'm going to put up a wall that you can't get through. And first of all, I think that's stupid. Because people go through things, even those that haven't served in the military or weren't police officers or whatever, people go through really hard things,
right,
and they may understand what you're going through. So I think it's a stupid reason not to get help. However, I understand it.
Yeah,
because of what you just said, it's just the camaraderie that comes from knowing it's going to be okay. I was going through the airport with some veterans as of a while ago now, and somebody just like it was a funny conversation, but somebody looked at us. I think it was three or four of us, and said, "Can I ask you guys a question?" Sure. When you look at people, is your first thought, I wonder what would happen if I threw them over that railing? And then he started to talk about, sometimes I look at people and the first thought I have is, I wonder what would happen if I just punched him in the face right now. And it was one of those like, and we all started laughing because
you all
maybe
done
not throwing over the railing, I don't
right
know, like I don't want to go to jail or anything, right?
Right?
But, you know, these thoughts, like, these are thoughts that I have because, you know, again, coming from a community where you're taught all of the time, everyone you come in contact with probably wants to hurt you.
Right.
So you need to be prepared for how you're going to deal with that.
Right.
Well, then you're walking through the airport, and those people don't want to hurt me. You know, but you have these thoughts. And it was just an interesting conversation. But I think to illustrate your point is you have to have people around you that you can have conversations like that that understand you and aren't going to think you're crazy for saying things that I'm not going to do that.
Right.
But I do have these thoughts sometimes because I've been programmed to have thoughts like this.
Right.
Right.
You know, I know objectively speaking that we're safe in this room.
Right.
But I'm still feeling better sitting with my back right. to the wall sure. and I can see the door and it still can, like my friends that know me, that even they know when we get to a restaurant, you know, it's the funniest thing in the world is to see, you know, a bunch of vets and cops try and sit at a table together right. and they're all jockeying for position sure. to see who can right. sit with their back to the wall. Mm-hmm. And it's programmed into us. You can't deprogram. Right. I shared a story on our episode with, and I kind of apologized to my dad. I said, if you're listening, you know, but I said, you know, I've been at Thanksgiving and had a random thought. You can't control it. It just goes yep. through your head and then you feel guilty that it goes through your head. But I was thinking, okay, so if somebody at this table goes sideways,
right.
who do I have to take out first?
Sure.
Right. Or, you know, I've had friends come to visit. And, you know, I haven't seen him in years. And I'm like, what if this guy's holding a secret grudge? Okay, so if I answer the door, he's got a gun. And everybody's like, that's insane. I'm like, yes. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
But it makes sense
but
to me.
But it makes sense to me. And they also don't understand there's this other part of us that it maybe isn't the, like, I'm a super badass, you know, ninja. But it's this sense of, you don't know how the real world works.
Sure, yeah, sure.
You know, I've seen the real world. And that's kind of how we're taught to view and what we're seeing is not the real world.
Right.
It's, you know, in law enforcement, they always say, you only deal with 20% of the population, but you deal with them 80% of the time.
Right, sure.
So your view is skewed, not theirs.
Right.
Yes, you have the scales have been lifted to a certain degree, but you have to understand that's not all of reality.
Right.
That's just all of your reality.
There's a broader reality.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah.
So everyone just has different perspectives on reality.
Exactly.
And that's what it comes down to.
And if you can't recognize that yours has been skewed by the traumatic and dramatic events of your life, then maybe time to sit down and read a book or two and reevaluate your priorities.
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
Well, we appreciate you having us down here and coming on the show. Yeah. I was kind of crazy. I just reached out and said, hey, we'd like to interview one of your guys.
I'm glad you did it.
And, you know, you guys got back to us to, and okay. And I told him, and he goes, really? He goes, are we going to go? I went through the program. I said, yeah, no, we're going to go down there.
Yeah, that's cool. No, I'm glad it worked out. And really do appreciate you guys coming down here. Yeah, that made it possible.
Yeah, and why they don't think what people understand is now we're going to turn off the podcast and flip the script and...
And then we'll do another one.
You can you can pick our brains for a minute. So how can people get a hold of us?
We're on Facebook, Instagram. Do we still have a Twitter?
We do, but I don't tweet. Twitter's
stay away from the Twitter.
Yeah,
stay away from the Twitter.
It's just garbage. If I could uninvent one thing, it would probably be Twitter.
Yeah. Wow.
So
that's the one thing you would pick.
Probably. It's toxic. It's garbage.
War Stories on Instagram, on Facebook.
Yeah. And, War Stories Official, because I guess there's a couple other podcasts where, you know, like.
But we pop, if you put in War Stories,
we pop up. Yeah. And you'll know our, because we have the flag with the multicolors, the support flag. It's, you know, got all the different colors for all the different, you know, public service. We get, you know, military and police and fire and EMS and stuff like that. So that's how people can find us on there. Facebook, the Instagrams. Don't forget to pre-order the coin and the shirt.
Oh, hold on. Before we get into the coins, you can go along with our long email.
Yes.
That I can never remember.
Yes, he can never remember. It's mailbag.warstories@gmail.com.
That is it.
That's right.
That is it. never remember that.
That's right. I remember your first time you're trying to give out, it's @war_stories_.
And I'm like, can someone write this down for me? This is ridiculous.
And then finally, War Stories Official, you can find us.
Yeah.
And then people can follow you, Jeremy, on social media, and they can follow Mighty Oaks Foundation.
That's right.
On social media.
Yeah, look up Mighty Oaks Foundation. You can go to our YouTube page. Just look for Mighty Oaks Show on YouTube. Or on Facebook, Instagram.
There's some really neat stuff. If you think, you know, what we're doing is cool, you're going to love what some of I've watched some of the stuff
we've been,
you guys have done.
We've been super blessed with some great opportunities and great partners, you know, folks like you guys that we can talk to and connect with. So,
Getting it out there because, if we don't fight for each other, then we can't fight for anybody else.
Yeah, I believe our community needs to take care of itself. Mm-hmm. And that means no disrespect to anyone else. But we need to stop blaming the government and everyone else for not taking care of us and stand up and take care of each other.
Yeah. The same people that don't want the government running healthcare and running the schools want the government running, you know, fixing the veterans. We do it ourselves.
Right. We don't need more money to Veterans Administration. Yeah. We just need to take care of each other.
Exactly.
So. You brought up the coins. Our coins are in full swing.
Full swing. We got the prototypes. They look amazing.
They do look amazing.
We posted a picture. Mm-hmm. I think I even gave the first one out to a friend of the show to kind of promote. So we're doing just for the listeners and for Jeremy, we are, one of our first interviews was a law enforcement officer by the name of Randy Sutton, who was on Cops. Okay. Interestingly enough, you've probably watched multiple episodes of him. He's Las Vegas Metro.
Okay, yeah.
And he came on and he talked about kind of the similar thing is police officers get no support a lot of times. They're afraid to come forward if they're experiencing nightmares or they're experiencing, you know, alcohol problems or relationship problems or whatever, because to do so is to risk the department snatching your badge and your gun from you and putting you out on a fitness for duty. Yeah. And then a lot of departments don't even cover PTSD as a workers' comp injury, if you
just
believe
see you later.
They just bye.
Wow.
So a lot of guys are afraid to get the help when they're in law enforcement. And so, because that's, you know, near and dear to my heart. So our first fundraiser, we're going to do a bunch of fundraisers over the course of this podcast, t-shirts and whatever. Yeah. But the first one we chose to do is, there's a documentary out there called The Wounded Blue that he was involved in as an executive producer that is officers telling stories of, you know, critical incident survival, being shot, you know, all kind of stuff. And then the aftermath of the post-traumatic stress and how they're just completely let go and given up on by the department.
That's incredible.
So he started the Wounded Blue Foundation, him and a couple of the people. And the Wounded Blue Foundation is providing peer support, peer counseling, and I believe in some cases financial assistance for officers that can't go to their department or can't go through their insurance. Because if they do, it's going to trigger a chain of events with their department that could jeopardize their entire career. Yep. So it's a way to get help and connect with other law enforcement officers that maybe have been there or trained in peer counseling. So we have a t-shirt that's based, we have a challenge coin, and then we have a t-shirt that's based on our challenge coin, and you can pre-order them right now. Once we cover the cost of manufacturing the t-shirts and the challenge coins, we're going to donate all that money to the Wounded Blue Foundation because they're just standing up right now. This is at the very beginning stages. You know, they're looking for grant writers and all the help they can get. So we thought we'd pick them as our first charity to help. So if people want to pre-order, they can email us. They can send us a message on the Instagrams and the Facebooks and all those social medias.
Hit them in the DM.
Hit us up.
And they do.
It's
really good, yeah.
So we until our next episode, as we always say, come home with your shield or on it.